BBC News at 9 o'clock. The international envoy to Syria, Kofi Annan, says he still hopes President Assad will implement a ceasefire tomorrow. The Syrian government had previously given an assurance that it would stop using its army against civilians calling for political change. But the opposition to Mr. Assad says the regime continues to attack towns and cities. Energy companies will have to notify their customers if they benefit from paying on a different tariff. The government wants the companies to contact every customer at least once a year. David Cameron has said he wouldn't object to a requirement that senior politicians had to publish their tax returns. Campaigners against abuse of the tax system argue that more openness is essential if the costs of government are to be spread fairly. The MP Ian Liddell Granger is chairman of the All-Party Group on Tax. He says the system is far too complicated and the rules need to be changed, but that can only be done with the support of accountants and tax experts.
What we need is a coherent cross-government way of dealing with tax evasion and make sure that we get it right. What we need is a lot more research into how we actually stop it. If we can then do that, I think it'll give George Osborne and right across the political spectrum the feeling that yes, we can sort this out. We can make it fair, because there is right problems with philanthropy. We've got to support that. But actually, let's make it fair for everybody across the United Kingdom.
Government officials in Greece say an election will be held early next month. Voters will have the chance to deliver their verdict on the cuts and austerity measures introduced as the price of an international bailout for their economy. Share traders in London are nervously watching the markets after big falls around the world yesterday. Share values have fallen again in the Far East markets. BMW says that it sold more vehicles in the first 3 months of the year than ever before. Sales of all three of its brands, BMWs, Minis and Rolls-Royces, were all up. BBC News.
This is BBC Radio 4. Good morning. In three quarters of an hour in our Book of the Week, it's 1943, and preparations are underway for the Allied landings in Normandy. Double Cross, the true story of the D-Day spies, continues at a quarter to ten. First, here's Libby Purvis with Midweek.
Hello. Today we have Dick Robinson's tribute to a great aunt, one of those remarkable First World War nurses at the battlefront. Greg Doran is soon taking over the helm at the Royal Shakespeare Company and right now bringing one of its most arresting recent plays to the West End. Sir Trevor MacDonald has been exploring the Mississippi and memories of Luther King. And the Fitzalan Howards, one of those intrepid couples who landed with an ancestral stately home, find ways to force it to earn its keep, involving everything from sweaty boot camps to dogs with an enormous amount of hair. Welcome, Elizabeth. We're going to be hearing about the Fitzalan Howards and their house, which is a wonderfully Victorian Gothic. Someone said Hogwarts, didn't they? One of our visitors said,
yeah.
I think I'm at Hogwarts. Yes, sort of a Victorian
Hogwarts.
So I thought I'd just ask you around the table about memorable houses. I'm Greg Doran, raised in Lancashire. You've had a life looking at every imaginable kind of theatre set. Where's your heart? The big and grand or the cosy domestic?
I suppose my perfect house is actually the little flat I live in, which overlooks the River Avon, right behind Holy Trinity Church. Kingfishers and herons on the river. What could be better?
So you'd rather look out than have grandeur inside?
Yeah, I suppose.
Trevor MacDonald, how about you? We're born in Trinidad, but 40 years in Britain. If you think perfect house, perfect home, where is it?
Yeah, but a stately home with sunshine, I think. A fair amount of sunshine. And decent showers, I think.
But you fancy a stately home, do you? There's nothing
well,
in your room.
Well, really stately, but with showers.
Dick Robinson, you were by chance born in Trinidad too. Where's your perfect house?
Well, like Greg, I have a house with a wonderful view, but I was watching the programme about Jonathan Miller the other night, and what I loved about it was that he's lived in that house for 50 years, and it's full of a lifetime of things he's accumulated.
It's a sort of carapace, isn't it?
we haven't got the room for that, but no, it'd be nice.
Well, I'm going to ask Gerald and Emma Fitzalan Howard, hand on heart, forgetting all accidents of birth and marriage, would you have chosen Carlton Towers?
Probably not. No, I think my favourite house would be on a beach somewhere, but with a bath, Trevor, not with a shower.
What would your perfect house have been?
I think it's a beautiful Queen Anne house. You know, just you know, that's the stunning ones you see on Pride and Prejudice. Just beautiful, that squareness, because Carlton is sort of so irregular.
Half covered in the fantastic bright red ivy.
Yes, well, that's a great
for the film it was. For the filming it was.
Yes, not ivy,
Virginia Creek. Their mind is on the fabric at all times. We're going to start, though, with the story of a young woman far from home throughout the Great War in France and Belgium behind the lines, Sister Edith Appleton of the Queen Alexandra's Imperial Military Nursing Service Reserve, an elite of nurses, all highly qualified before the war, and they were demanded to be of a high social status. But she was a remarkable diarist, and now her writing is published in association with the Imperial War Museum as War Diaries, A Nurse at the Front. And her great-nephew is Dick Robinson. And you actually knew her, didn't you? You knew this great-aunt of yours.
I did. We came back to this country, actually, from Trinidad in 1946, and when my father went off to look for a house for the family, we stayed with Edie, who was a widow by then, and a couple of sisters and her brother, retired vicar Fred, in a wonderful house called Buddlebrook in Bryston in the Isle of Wight.
And what was she like? What was this old lady like?
This was just after the war. Things were tight.
The Second War, 1946.
Things were pretty tight, and I remember rather severe, strict, upright lady. She did have a passion for chickens. And in fact, much earlier, she was asked to go back and do nursing again, said, no, it's chickens. I want to devote my life to raising poultry. And they had a wonderful garden full of chickens and an orchard and vegetables.
And she was near the sea, wasn't she? She was near the Isle of Wight.
Not far, no. I mean, we used to go off, to the sea regularly.
That great love of the sea and of nature is runs all through the book, in between all the horrors of death and injury she saw every day. I mean, that's why it's so striking. That, you know, just as it's breaking your heart, you know, there's suddenly this fantastic description of a landscape or a sky.
Yes, I think it's what allowed her to remain so resilient and resolute and strong in what she was, the horrors she was dealing with every day, was this ability to go off and enjoy a picnic. Extraordinary. She writes of sitting on a hill overlooking Ypres, battle going on not far away, having a picnic. I mean, you know. It's an image one can hardly
Well, there is
imagine.
A sense all through it of they had to be a community. I mean, you know, the medical officer playing jokes on the unpopular Roman Catholic chaplain, yes, putting water in his boots and so on. You know, that all this stuff is, yes, going on at the same time because life has to go on. They were young people. They
were. Edie was 37, and at one point there's a lovely bit in the diary where she's asked by a medical officer, you know, what about marriage? And my day is done, I'm too old. Actually, she did get married.
She did. She had a marriage after the war, didn't she, for 10 years. It was wonderful. Just pick out one extraordinary moment. Here's a February day, and within a few lines, you've got a 24-year-old dying of gas gangrene, an amputation, the news that her former driver has been shot as a spy, and a little line about spy vermin, they're everywhere. And then suddenly, this is a morning to be alive, everything covered in snow and the impatient cold sea beating itself into white foam at my very feet. She moves between the two things remarkably.
She does, and I think it's what kept her sane, probably. And I guess, you know, in a sense, that was a luxury that someone in the position that she was in had. You know, compare her experience with men in the trenches who were there for the duration.
But she spares nothing. I mean, baldly relating how so many men were just brought in to die and said, well, you just have to make them comfortable and pack their internal organs back inside and make them comfortable for the few hours they have left.
Yes, she did have one or two bits in the diary where she writes very movingly about particular people. She names over 200 people in the diary.
I know, and in a way it's memorial to them, and one hopes that there wouldn't even be descendants, probably, their great nephews and nieces will read the book and find it. I mean, the youth of these boys. You know, one lad who was clearly 15 but said, I'm 18, regimentally.
Yes.
The ones who cheated to get to the front.
Yeah.
And the way they die, it's very striking, the care and kindness. She says, I always give them clean handkerchiefs, which they seem to love.
Yes. So you mentioned one she calls my little boy Kerr. And in the last month, I've had contact from a great-great-niece of Charlie Kerr. And I find these extraordinarily powerful and moving, these contacts. And I'm going to meet her when I go up to visit my daughter up in
Yorkshire. Is he the one who died very quietly, is it?
Yes, and will you kiss me when I'm gone?
There's a description, I think. He loved all that was done for him, his warm, clean clothes, hot bottles and hot drinks, smiled very sweetly. Yes, and some of the deaths are terrible and painful, but you know, she loved it when they're
And she doesn't spare her description. When you think she... I don't know whether it was just a device, but she writes to her mother. It's as though the diaries very often are addressed to her mother. And that's one of the things that struck me, is how she could be so frank and honest. And I guess that's the kind of person she was.
It was that kind of family, wasn't it? I mean, the father, I'm again very struck because I'm fond of pilots, and they still die in these cases. The father was a Trinity pilot who was still trying to board a
Castle
ship.
Yes.
So, you know, it was not the sort of family that had been shielded from...
No, and typically late Victorian family, you know, they went off. So I had lots of relatives now in New Zealand and Australia and Canada, and that was typical of those large families. So they were intrepid lot, no doubt.
It's very striking how the nurses, like her, did often manage, despite, I mean, she'll sometimes write, there had been no time to write at all, there's so many men coming in, but so often she could sit with the dying individuals for hours. She'd be sitting making lace and talking to them and with them. You know, given that now in a civilian hospital in peacetime, people sometimes die untended and without someone sitting beside them, it's very moving that this seemed important, isn't it?
Yes, it does. I think the circumstances must have changed from day to day, week to week, in that, you know, there were times when she wasn't able to.
But she was clearly, if there was an opportunity to sit with a dying man, that's what she would do.
Yes, certainly.
I love the story about that. There's quite a lot of humour in it as well, the nursing the German casualties, and she gets very annoyed that her group of Bosch, are giggling about a cartoon of the Kaiser in one of the magazines. And she says they shouldn't be so disrespectful to their leader. They just say, oh, nobody takes him seriously. No one takes him seriously. And a lovely moment where, in the hysteria of chaos and death, the nurses are suddenly falling about laughing because of their little corporal asks, should this man be buried as an officer or a private, and if he's there a difference. And he explains that when it comes to coffin lids, men are hammered down, officers are screwed.
That's right, yes. I mean, did anybody know that? I didn't. Does it still go on, maybe, one wonders?
It's probably all Velcro or something. What was it like for you finding these guys? I know they've been, it happens so often, they're in a family for a long time, and everyone says, oh, yes, that's a trunk full of on TV and stuff.
I first knew about them in 1958 when Edie died. My mum cleared her house, brought them home. I've actually got still the pages where I started typing
them up. You bought a volume in today. We've been gazing at a lovely drawing.
Yes, there's some lovely sketches. But so I knew about these. I started typing them up. They went back in a drawer for another 50 years. And it wasn't until my mum died in 97 that I got them. Went back in another drawer. Chance conversation with a neighbour of mine in Blockley in Gloucestershire. And she said, you ought to get these published. And I set up a website. I mean, it's a long story. A website, they were broadcast on the BBC. Now there's a book. Who knows what might be next? Mm. It's a long journey, but...
I wonder what she would have thought of that. She'd probably just be glad she named so many of the boys, wouldn't she?
I think she would. Yes, as I mentioned, over 200 people. I think... In some ways, I'm surprised there are so many names. There must have been sort of censorship going on, how these diaries got home.
She probably just thought she had them with them.
She
went to one leave once a year or whatever.
Yes.
Of course, there's a missing bit, which is very tantalising, like more Pogo's introduction. Where is it?
Well, yes, I have this fantasy that it's tucked away in a museum or a drawer somewhere in the Isle of Wight, and I must go and visit. But if there's anybody out there who thinks they know, please let me know.
Well, I'm looking at it, that you brought the volume in, which we're keeping well away from the glasses of water on the studio table. We're all kind of rather looking at it as a relic, aren't we?
Yes.
It feels important.
I know, I ought to be wearing white gloves every time I go near it, but it's
in controlled temperature.
Yeah. But it feels close to me and something I can touch quite happily.
Oh, it is, and it's redolent with personality and things like that. It's a wonderful book. Anyway, we're going to turn from theatres of war and of medicine to theatre as theatre, because here is Greg Doran, 25 years a stalwart of the Royal Shakespeare Company, now just named its new artistic director. He has personally directed at least half the Shakespeare canon, plus everything from Mallory to Stoppard, and right now has a new Julius Caesar underway.
Indeed.
Set in modern-day Africa with an all-black British cast.
Yeah, it's the first time the RSC have fielded a completely black Shakespeare cast. The reason for doing it in that particular way actually comes from discovering that Nelson Mandela had a copy of Shakespeare on Robben Island, and they handed it round. It was disguised as a Hindu prayer book, and the inmates would underline particular lines that were potent for them. So Walter Sisulu underlines Shylock's lines, "For sufferance is the badge of all our tribe." Whereas one of the other inmates underlined Caliban's line, "This island's mine by Sycorax, my mother." And between those two lines,
you get
I remember, I mean, you're absolutely right, because I remember I once talked to him, quite informally, long after I'd interviewed him, about what it was that kept him sane after these long, you know, unconscionable years in prison. And he said to me, "And why were you not afraid, I said? Why were you not terrified of the guards?" And he said, "Cowards die many times before their deaths." And then I went on to quote the entire line. He said, "And of all the wonders I've yet seen, it seems to me most strange that men should fear, seeing that death, the necessary end, will come when it will come."
Exactly.
And I was absolutely surprised. And he said to me, he said, "We read Shakespeare's too, you know."
Those are the exact lines that Mandela autographed.
Yes,
he
quoted them to me. I mean, I must confess, you know, to see him sitting, we were sitting in a hotel suite in Birmingham, and, you know, of all the wonders. And I thought, wonderful, absolutely.
Well, it started as a sort of instigation to look back at Julius Caesar through the filter of, as it were, those lines. And then I discovered that Julius Nyerere, the first president of Tanzania, had also translated Julius Caesar into Swahili. And it became the idea of a sense that this was, as John Carney, the great South African actor, said, it's Shakespeare's African play. Mm. And I thought, in the context of Africa since independence, if the last 50 years, if you like, you have this history, this kind of distillation of history, of freedom fighters turning into presidents of their countries. Occasionally these turn into despots, into tyrants. There's overthrows, military coups, civil wars, and it's happened so often in Africa that you can see that Julius Caesar, a play that talks about regime change, would fit that context.
Yes. I mean, sometimes in the soppy old West, we actually have to look to other communities. I mean, somebody said Romeo and Juliet, you know, you want to see that. Go to the Asian community.
Yeah.
Happens all the time.
Yeah.
Must ask you about the other thing as well, because you have an opening at the West End shortly, at the Duchess Theatre, where the commercial producers, Thelma Holt and Bill Kenwright, have taken on your production of David Edgar's new play, which you did in the Swan, about William Tyndale and the making, 70 years later, of the King James Bible from his work, Written on the Heart. It must be both a surprise and a delight, because this is a serious historical play. It's riveting, it's a beautiful play, but not a natural.
It's a courageous thing for Thelma and Bill Kenway to take in. But it is, it's a terrific play that David Edgar has written. And in many ways, different from the sort of plays that David has written before, partly because it's historical, because it's set in the Jacobean period. But also, we did a run of the play, which David didn't attend, in fact, in Stratford, I remember one day, and I phoned David in the evening, and he said, "Oh, how did the run go?" And I said, "Well, do you know, David, it was short, moving, and funny." And David said, three adjectives not normally associated with David Edgar. So it is, it's a surprising play.
Well, the figure of Tyndale, I think, it's such a shining, sort of frothy, working class, angry, democratic figure, and then 70 years later, all these miserable political Anglican grandees kind of sniffering around it and trying to change words to make it more posh.
You get the sense that Lancelot Andrews, who was the great translator of the 1611 section, that Andrews is attempting to reach some kind of compromise. It's, the play, in a way, is a great paean to British compromise, that there's that in this context of rabid faith issues. I mean, we have to remember that 5/11 had just happened in the Jacobean period with the gunpowder plot, and I think that the play takes that very dangerous world and shows you how the King James Bible was a product of that as a political gesture.
But this man who was persecuted sort of 70 years earlier, and then they come around and say, well, actually, he was right. Yeah. But on the other hand, we can't have the serpent saying tush to Eve.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of rude. I suppose it is one of the challenges of the ROC, which is now your big baby, to make rather thoughtful grown-up plays into something which is irresistible to everyone. I mean, that's the trick, isn't it? Is to make entertainment and excitement out of something which a lot of people go, whoa, I think...
It's a really important challenge for the ROC to, alongside the Shakespeare that, of course, is our middle name, to be able to produce both the classics of the contemporaries of Shakespeare, but also new writing. And that was one of Peter Hall's, founding planks of the company, that we should put them both together. And I think a play like Written on the Heart, or indeed that Helen Edmondson's Heresy of Love, which we did alongside that play, we did it with Measure for Measure, and the plays somehow fed into each other. So there's a great sense of one of the great things about coming to Stratford, seeing the RSC, is being able to see plays in the context, that you can see them both in the context.
There's also a sense of a tradition that not all playwrights have to be long dead.
Indeed.
there's always, of course, an urge to do Shakespeare differently. To set it in a laundromat or Las Vegas or a psychiatric ward, a need to surprise. As a director, when you're approaching a very well-known play, do all sorts of things flip through your head?
Some people often say to me, so how are you going to do it? And I kind of say, well, I hope I'm just going to do it. Now, having just said I'm setting Julius Caesar in post-colonial Africa, then clearly I am. But each play presents different challenges, I think. And the real danger is that you get into a mentality of, if it's Tuesday, it must be as you like it. Each time you do a play, there has to be a reason, there has to be a sort of event behind it. It's either because you've got David Tennant to play Hamlet, or there's a real context that illuminates the play in some way, as I hope the African context to Julius Caesar will illuminate it.
But often there's just a sort of sense of, let's surprise the audience, for heaven's sake. Let's do Midsummer Night's Dream with a whole lot of chairs dangling from your head.
I had a wonderful old teacher at Bristol Old Vic Theatre School called Rudy Shelley, and he used to wag his finger at me and say, Greg, don't want to be clever. That was the best bit of advice for a classical director.
I think as a schoolboy, you actually got together your own Shakespearean troupe called the Poor Players, didn't you? And
how did you know that?
I'm not sure
why we called ourselves the Poor Players. We ought to have called ourselves the Strutting and Fretting Company. But we did a Shakespeare play every year at school, and I was at a Jesuit college in Preston, and we had a wonderful teacher called Arthur Malone who would do a Shakespeare play every year. So it started from that, playing an all-male school, so I got to do my Lady Macbeth, definitively. In fact, when I directed Harriet Walter as Lady M, on her press night, I gave her a photograph of me playing the part, which she said was the weirdest first night card she'd ever had from a director.
Yeah, you've been 25 years with the RSC, sort of associate director, and also 25 years with your partner Anthony Sher. I must ask you about this business because it's such an engrossing trade. You must think and dream and worry all the time about stuff you're doing, and he must as well. Is it true that, as he says in an interview, you once threw a plate at him?
I'm afraid it is. We were doing a production of Titus Andronicus in Johannesburg for the Market Theatre, and we just hadn't worked out how not to bring work home. So I would want is a sort of gin and tonic and sit in the garden, and he would want to talk about Act 3, Scene 1, and what were we going to do about that act 3. Eventually, I guess he wouldn't stop, so I threw a plate of peas at him. It is true.
You have a good aim, do you?
No, actually not.
Yes.
Luckily for him.
Another relationship,
no,
of course.
But we met during Merchant of Venice, and I was an actor in Sluts with them, and there was a moment where I had to shout the line, I was playing salami, one of the salads, or the salad rolls, at the RSE. And I had to shout this line at him. I had to shout, "'Tis the most impenetrable cur that ever kept with men." And apparently one night I shouted, "'Tis the most impenetrable cur that ever slept with men." And the rest is history.
I mean, how easy is it going to be for you as a very focused director to be overall artistic director? Will there not be a sense of having to sort of fragment your attention a bit more?
I'm sure. I hope it'll be about the team that I eventually pull around me. Luckily, because Michael Boyd and Vicky Haywood have given a good handover period, I get a whole... Basically, I don't start planning until 2014, so I get a bit of time to work out, get my team together, work out what it is, that how I want to refocus the company and where I want
to... But when things are happening, I mean, there will be other directors, associate directors who are maverick, who do strange things, who set plays in strange ways, which you have your doubts about. That's quite hard, isn't it, when you're the overall... carry the can overall.
Richard Eyre, in his wonderful... autobiography about being artistic director of the National, says that the biggest thing he had to learn was generosity, and I suspect that might be the case.
Yes, well, and you obviously, and how to dangle things from 50 feet overhead. It's a very tall theatre you have.
Yeah, it is. Well, I'm looking at this. Julius Caesar will be the first
player
I have directed. Actually, there's nobody yet flying in Julius Caesar. I'm going to have to think of some way of flying in the ghost.
No dangling.
In Julius
Caesar. Trevor McDonald dangled in from overhead, leaving the news.
That sounds almost obscene. What's the urge, though? I mean, to make... I understand why it's done, but what's the kind of sort of philosophical urge to make things contemporary?
I don't think it has to be contemporary at all, though, you know, quite people often...
Julius Caesar in post-colonial Africa is
that's pretty contemporary.
Reasonably contemporary.
Yeah, no, and I think it makes the play work in a different way, and that the problem sometimes with Julius Caesar is the second half can seem like a dying fall. When we were working on the idea last year, and the Arab Spring was happening, what you were aware of was that the big question was not, are they going to get rid of Gaddafi? The big question was, what follows Gaddafi?
Indeed.
And that's the big question in Julius Caesar.
Let's go now to Sir Trevor McDonald's journey for ITV along 2,500 miles of the Mississippi River from the Deep South, with its troubled racial and civil war conflicts right up to Minnesota. The series began last night, but I want to. You start off down in New Orleans, the slave plantation, and failing to play the tuba, I have to say.
Yes, I know. Rather miserably, yes. Thank you for that.
I thought everyone...
Just when I was about to embark on a new career.
Everyone's seen this
had
now.
It smashed.
But it's next week's episode, which I found absolutely fascinating, which we'd like to talk about a bit in advance, when you reach Memphis, because there are two big things here, and the really big one is the assassination of Martin Luther King. Now, you're Caribbean-born rather than American-born, but as a teenager, you must have followed the civil rights movement. You must have been old enough to feel the shock in 68.
Oh, I was, and I did. And what I found terribly, terribly strange was it all came back so poignantly. And to revisit the story, to discover again that I'm not too sure how I knew all the details, but to discover he'd gone there the first time to Memphis to support sanitation workers who were on strike, garbage workers. And his aide said to him, "Martin, they're garbage workers. You have a movement to run here. Why are we making this journey in their support? I mean, sure, they deserve support, but do they need you, and do they need the popularity that you bring to the thing?" And of course, the first time, it went terribly badly, in that it broke up, and there was a lot of violence. And Martin Luther's dislike of any kind of violence was so profound that he was rather, you know, surprised and hated the fact that it had become so disorderly, and so was determined to go back to have a proper demonstration, which was non-violent. And for me, I never understood how strong that philosophy of nonviolence was. I mean, I thought, you know, people said, okay, we mustn't fight. And that was it. But he really actually believed it, was disturbed about the first instance and went back. And then this sort of petty crook, James Earl Ray, who was around, shot him. And we met the man who was with him.
The Reverend Kyle. Wonderful Reverend Kyle, who was at his last rally and was next to him when he was
shot. And was going to take him home to dinner that night.
That brought me closer to thinking about the events than anything else I've seen. It must have been extraordinary. Moving for you.
And the night before, I mean, I thought Reverend Kyle was a marvellous man. I mean, to have an eyewitness like that, who was taking him home to dinner, but also was with him the night before. It was a filthy night, and Martin Luther King was due to go to this church, and he said, why am I going to this church? Because, quite frankly, nobody's going to be there. No one will come out in this weather. And he turned up, and the church was absolutely full. And there he delivered this amazing speech, which, I must say, when you hear it even now, you can't control
it. This is the one where he says, "I may not reach the promised land." And he'd said to Kyle, "I won't reach 40, they'll get me." I mean, he was in the deep south.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, the other fascinating thing is the after effect on Memphis as a city, because of the riots after the assassination all over America, and because it became, I mean, he had nothing to do with Memphis, he'd just gone there to help this one cause, but businesses pulled out and
Memphis died.
People left, the city almost expired.
There are people, if you go there today, and I hope one is not doing the city a discredit in saying this, but it's unlike any other large American city, and people said to me, it could be like Atlanta. You know, which is very busy, very vibrant. But Memphis is dead. People just moved out in droves. It became stained by the association with the assassination of Martin Luther King. Almost never recovered.
The two people, you see a very cheerful philanthropist lady who's always believed in Memphis and has sort of stuck with it. But also an extraordinary business fact that one of the things which saves it economically is that FedEx sort of takes over the airport, the whole airport, every night, and 60% of all its global parcel trade is sorted in Memphis. So if you're sending something out of China to New Zealand, it's probably going to be sorted by night workers in Memphis.
It was extraordinary. I mean, to see, you know, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, it's an airport which takes people from New York or from Dallas or wherever, and then it shuts down, and it's FedEx. And these planes just turn up and go out again.
And a mass, I mean, 10,000 night workers come in, who I have to say seem to be almost all black and quite low paid. So we're still
I think FedEx are doing a good job there with their staff. Mm. But no, it was something quite unreal to see this. But it showed a kind of ingenuity, really, you know, because airports at night, and with all the regulations about low-flying aircraft and, you know, disturbing people and so on, they are not being used. And Memphis is out of the airport is way out of the city.
It's a reasonable way to use it.
And it's a very, very reasonable way to use it. So it's quite this. But to see all those parcels, I mean, the jumble, the confusion, the mass of them, you think they'll never, ever sort it. You'll never get any. I know why I haven't got my book or something. Because we're just never going to happen. But apparently it does. And they'll FedEx anything anywhere.
Pandas. With other things, it brings us curiously that the fact that I am noticing that there's a lot of black, low-paid, quite low-status workers, though I have to say they do have health insurance. You meet Morgan Freeman, who played Mandela, and he tells you about his memories of growing up separate, absolutely separate benches, separate seats, everything, separate restaurants, but not caring what the white folks did.
Well,
he said he actually, in childhood, it didn't bother him a bit, and then he grew up and suddenly realised it was appalling.
Yes. I thought the not caring line was a slight defence mechanism bit, really, because I think what people do is you try to pretend that you're not affected by something which profoundly hurts you. And so to get it away and to pretend, you know, to make sure that it doesn't really, you know, open up all the scars, you think, well, I'll pretend that this doesn't exist. I think it did hurt him. And I think the fact that he tried to do something about it later on in his life is shows that it did hurt. But he organized an all-white black and white prom, I thought one of the things about traveling through the South is the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964, and in 1980, in 1990, there are still people who have separate proms, black and white, and I couldn't get a handle on that. You know, everything has changed and nothing has changed. Mm-hmm. And America is this extraordinary panorama of experiences of this sort.
Lovely bit of racial irony there too, because the other huge Memphis thing is Elvis. The place is still a shrine to Elvis. I thought what he was doing was bringing a black musical energy into white rock music.
He did, yes, he did. And I was not always a great Elvis fan, but of course the reputation is one which you can't at all ignore. And to see this studio being made into a shrine, and to find out that where Elvis always stood with his back to the sound recordist, either because of lack of confidence or didn't just want to catch his eye, and was sort of faced the other way. But people now come and kiss the spot where Elvis stood, and Bob Dylan came to do that, and to be around.
Just now when you said I was not always, I thought you were about to say I was not always a dignified knight of the realm. But you see me now, I used to be a real Elvis raver.
I used to have arguments with my brother about Elvis. He was a real Elvis fan.
And how many Elvis still poll on the table, Elvis fans?
No. Oh gosh, yes. No. Nothing terribly well.
Just me and Greg Dora. We should be having a little dance after. Oh gosh, well, let's turn finally to Lord and Lady Gerald Fitzalan Howard. That is the correct way to put it. They're also part of a television series. It's called The Guest Wing. It's about stately homeowners who keep the place going with private and corporate events and how it feels to do that. It's very entertaining. It starts, is it tonight or tomorrow? Is it?
It's tomorrow night.
It's tomorrow night. I'm now going to stop doing the Lord and Lady thing, if I may, and stick to Christian Age. I do notice that even Downton Abbey hasn't yet persuaded people to get titles right. All your guests insist on saying Lady Emma, not Lady Gerald, don't they?
Because I wasn't born a lady.
That's right. Is that right? You know,
confusing.
Diana's proper title was Princess Charles.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't have that.
Because Lady Gerald just sounds wrong to them, I guess. Yeah.
And people think, my God, how extraordinary, they're the same name.
But I love the way you just basically roll with the culture, don't you?
It's fine. I mean, you're not going to question it. It just sounds so pedantic.
And also you seem to roll with the commentator saying, Gerald and his remarkably well-preserved wife, Emma. Just insulting.
I mean, that's just like some old galleon or something, you know.
And they made a suggestion that Gerald looked you should also clear up the Lord thing, because this is one of the non-hereditary titles, isn't it? You don't have to go to the House of Lords.
Yeah, it's purely a Kirsty title.
Means
nothing.
And the business, I mean, I can't see how you'd have time for the House of Lords anyway. It feels like a full-time job, running a house.
I think it is, yes.
Did you always mean to? Because, I mean, the house came to you after you were married, you'd both been in business, you'd had your own lives.
Yeah, I mean, the house was built in, it goes back to the Doomsday Book. So it's been rebuilt. Its last rebuilding was in 1870s by my great uncle, who was completely mad.
Hence the insane Victorian Gothic.
Absolutely.
Right.
And it would have been double the size.
Yeah.
It was going to be double the size, but he luckily ran out of money and went bankrupt. He then died. His brother inherited the debt, and the house was actually sold. He then luckily married an heiress.
An American
and the house
area.
Was... No,
not American, Broughton Hall.
A Yorkshire area. And brought back over the bankruptcy courts. And so we, live on. The family motto is Mieux sera, which means it will be better.
The house was passed on to you by your brother. And, did you always intend to make a family home of it and to run it as a business? Because it eats you up, a property like that, doesn't it?
And we definitely wanted to be a family home.
Absolutely.
I mean, there was no question of that. And also, we have to run it like a business, because otherwise it would just rot. You just cannot... It's the only way we could do it.
So you have to become a venue, which is
absolutely. It does work quite well in the fact that there is a sort of a family wing that we do have privacy in. And in the main wing... it is too big to be a family house. So actually it works incredibly well for, weddings, conferences, things like that. Little did he know it, but my great-great-uncle, was building the perfect conference centre.
Conference centre. And of course, you had been in the car industry in business before
So you both had a bit of business savvy. I love the bit where you're sitting talking about ordering paper cups online.
Yeah.
How you can get the ones with lids really cheap.
Well, you can do it, right?
You can see great TV. You're riveted already.
Well, I think what people enjoy also...
I mean, compared to the stuff you do, really.
Well, no, it is. It's theatricality. I mean, your butler, Steve, is superb.
Well, he's not actually strictly our butler. That sounds so grand. I mean, he is the butler for the venue, but he doesn't come in and serve us our gin and tonic.
He's a conference man. But people want him to be a butler. They want him to be Downson. And he looks like something out of P.G. Woodhouse.
But
then he greets people incredibly friendly way, and they all melt.
I know. It was so good. Gerald, my son Arthur was in our local shop, which was a lovely scruffy little shop in Carlton the other day. And Steve was down there as well. And he came up and said, "Good morning, sir." And this is, he's 20, Arthur. He just felt so embarrassed because all these people were sort of around, you know, buying a fag. You know, and he just sort of, there he was. He was everyone mom and sir.
The commentary speaks of a collision of cultures. I mean, though you are not kind of cartoon toffs, really, that people sort of want you to be, don't they? And then they want to arrive, and Lady Emma's taking part in the boot camp exercise class.
Isn't she wonderful? Yes. Not a bit of it.
How condescending she is.
Well, I hope they didn't think that, but, if they did, they're not trying to be.
In a good way. But I like the way people are sort of slightly daunted by the place. What do you see in people who arrive? Who are from completely different backgrounds, they're coming for a wedding or an event or something.
I think they're sort of daunted to start with, but hopefully when they start using the venue, using the building, or meeting us or whoever, they sort of find that it is all friendly. And
I think they're gobsmacked by the building because it is enormous and it's extraordinary. I mean, it's quite an acquired taste, but it is a sort of an enormous pile that
kind of houses a Parliament Square, really, sort of over the top and down the other side.
It was designed by Edward Welby Pugin, who was Augusta Pugin's son. And the interior was done by John Francis Bentley, who did Westminster Cathedral. So it's got some names.
They were building themselves big stage sets, weren't they?
Right? They were indeed,
Do you ever get any kind of hostility? Do you ever get sort of class warriors turning up and saying this is disgraceful?
No. No, it hasn't happened yet. Not at all.
No.
We might off the programme, I don't know.
I doubt it. I like the way you say that there's nothing to do with class. There's class and there's classy. And some of the class people you know of are not classy. And some working class people are classy. I like that. Class or classy.
I'm glad you proved it.
What's your favourite kind of event? Did you really truly enjoy the dog show?
Yes, I thought it was fantastic. I mean, we have it regularly, but we haven't really attended. They didn't ask us to, never asked us to attend before. I mean, it's just extraordinary. The passion for Afghans.
Yeah.
Because they are the weirdest looking dogs, aren't they?
Yeah, but they are very useful.
They are.
And it is sometimes true about dogs and owners looking a bit alike.
I love that.
It was
quintessentially British.
Yeah.
I mean,
what's the stickiest kind of event? You haven't had to do party conferences or anything like that.
We've never had anything sort of political or
BBC away days or really kind of tricky, badly behaved people.
We would love that.
We're not going to do Glastonbury on the years they have off.
Oh, I would love to.
We'd love to do a pop conference.
Yeah, right.
But
any promotion. Look alike.
We're festivals, but festivals are just kind of penny now, aren't they? Everyone's doing festivals. I don't know if we could. Love to do that.
They can do something Shakespearean.
Yeah. Honestly, the backdrop is something else. Listen, we do lots of dangly things. Anything you like. Okay, sorry.
Speaking of that, you must have a lot of fun with the health and safety regulations surrounding venues.
Oh.
Is there a lot of paperwork? Do you work hard at that?
Steve does. Back to Steve.
Yeah, no, so Steve does all that.
What do you do then? Come on, do work. Can't have people saying that we've got these idle tossed on.
No, well, we do. We just oversee it all, and we attend meetings, and we
Gerald's too busy ordering paper cups. It's worth watching anyway, just to see Gerald in his jacket, which is made of upholstery fabric, because he admires the morning room curtains and wished to blend.
Yeah.
God heavens. That's it, I'm afraid, for this week. We've run out of time. Thanks to Fitzalan Howard and Dick Robinson, Trevor MacDonald and Greg Doran. Back next week, then, among us will be Roberta Taylor. Bye.
Midweek was presented by Libby Purvis. The producer was Paula McGinley. In a moment on Radio 4 Long Wave, it's the Daily Service, while we continue our Book of the Week about D-Day spies here on FM. Then at 10, it's Woman's Hour, and at 11, this.
The ocean was flat as a bathtub.
Eyewitness testimony from survivors of the Titanic disaster.
The sea was the calmest I think I've ever seen.
Modern day insights.
That actually makes icebergs, providing there's no moon, more difficult rather than easier to spot.
Seems as if the whole world is standing still.
Peter Snow charts the events leading up to the fateful voyage.
Once the iceberg was sighted, Titanic had just 47 seconds to try and steer around it.
Random Edition on BBC Radio 4. The Sinking of the Titanic Special. This morning at 11.
But now, here on BBC Radio 4, we continue our Book of the Week. Jonathan Keeble reads from Double Cross, The True Story of the D-Day Spies by Ben McIntyre. By 1943, Section B1A of MI5 is running a group of double agents, feeding false information to German intelligence. They're an eccentric bunch, and the constant need to flatter, monitor, cajole, and sustain them